Now let's turn to Psalm 39. Something happened to the person who wrote this psalm. Something traumatic. We don't know what it was, and that's probably as well. If the psalmist had outlined for us specifically what happened to him, there's always the possibility that we would have said, oh, well, that's nothing. You should see what happened to me. But because we don't know what it was, we can relate to him. There is not a person here who at one stage or other in his or her life has not been exposed to traumatic events. When these traumatic events come our way, we feel so utterly helpless. There's nothing we can do about them. Life is like that. Life introduces us to circumstances and to people about which or about whom we can do nothing at all. We love to feel that we're in control, but when we lose control, anxiety results. Anxiety can turn into resentment. Resentment can become anger. If this anxiety, if this resentment, if this anger is not handled well, it can begin to produce in us some deep-rooted emotions that can have all kinds of negative effects upon us. They can have negative physiological effects, can have negative psychological effects, can have negative relational impact. It can even affect us deeply as far as our spiritual lives are concerned. We need to be thinking in terms of how we respond to, how we react to the affairs of our lives over which we have no control. When it comes to anger, that is, being an indignant reaction to a real or perceived injustice, there are different ways that we can handle it. The four classic ways that we read about that we can handle anger are as follows. We can try repression, suppression, expression, or confession. Let me briefly outline these four for you. When we talk about repression, we mean that we are angry, but we refuse to admit it. We have been exposed to somebody or something that we feel has imposed upon us that which is unjust. We feel that we have been demeaned. We feel that we have not been treated in a manner appropriately. So we then decide that we're going to handle these feelings of indignation by refusing to admit that they're there. This is not an uncommon way of dealing it as far as evangelical Christians are concerned. Many evangelical Christians have got the idea that anger is always, by definition, wrong. And therefore, if they have anger feelings, they know they're wrong. They feel that the way to handle it is to refuse to admit that it's there, to behave in such a manner that they do not convey this impression. Now, of course, this is based on erroneous thinking because anger is by definition not always wrong. God is good and angry. God would not be God if he were not angry at times. If God did not act indignantly at injustice, if God was not indignant about evil, then he would fail to be a God of justice and a God of righteousness. And there is a sense in which human beings at times are required to be good and angry. Therefore, we should not assume that anger is always wrong, and we should never fall into the trap of feeling that repressing anger is the way to handle it. I remember one occasion a lady called me, and I picked up the phone, and as usual I said, "Hello, Stuart Briscoe here." And the lady simply said to me, "Now, Stuart, I don't want you to think I'm angry." And I said, "Well, why then did you bring up the subject?" And she promptly exploded. And she was in classic repression of anger. She was refusing to admit that in actual fact, the reason she was calling me was she was madder than a wet hornet, but not prepared to admit that was the case. Another way of handling anger is suppression. Suppressing anger means that when I am indignant about this particular situation, about this particular person, I feel that I must not in any way let people know that I'm angry. I interpret that as I must not be angry, and therefore I stuff it all down inside. So, for instance, you have a committee meeting, and you make a proposal in the committee meeting, and nobody takes your proposal seriously. You can't even get a second for the motion. And you feel totally demeaned. You feel that people aren't taking you seriously, and you get very infuriated about it. But you know that you mustn't in any way let the people know. You mustn't, quote, be angry about it. So you stuff the anger inside. You get very cool, and then you get very cold, and then you become very withdrawn, and then you become very bitter, and then you have nothing to do with the people ever again. And you pride yourself that you never, quote, got angry, when in actual fact, you were as angry as it was possible to be. You simply suppressed it. Now, the main problem, of course, with repressing or suppressing your anger is that if these emotions are not dealt with, they will be, as the psalmist put it, like a fire inside you, stoking up like the molten inside of the world, which eventually bursts out through a weak spot in a volcanic eruption. We've seen many, many instances in our culture, in our society, of exactly this sort of thing happening, where people are not handling their anger. It bursts out eventually in some abusive behavior, sometimes even violent behavior. We're all very much aware of what happens in many marriages, where on the outside everything seems to be perfectly normal, but in actual fact, all kinds of violence, all kinds of abuse is being perpetrated simply because people are not handling their anger well. There's another way of handling anger, of course, that is different from suppression and repression, and that is expression. There are some people who pride themselves in that they never hide their feelings. You never need to worry what I'm thinking. I'll let you know. You'll know what I feel about every situation. These people, for some strange reason, feel that it is most appropriate that when they are angry, they do absolutely nothing at all to engage in self-control. They let it all hang out. Those kind of people have sometimes learned a Greek word to explain and to excuse their behavior. They talk rather knowledgeably about catharsis. What that means is getting all the junk out. And there's no question about it that it's rather like pressing a boil and getting rid of all the infection. You feel great. The problem is, who got all the infection loaded all over them? Obviously, you may feel better expressing your anger. You may feel better not bottling it up, and there's no question about it. If you go in for repression or suppression, there's a pretty good chance you'll go in for ulcers too. But if you're into expression, you'll have no ulcers, folks. Everybody else around you will, but you won't. And so we can handle our anger either by repression or suppression or expression. Neither of these ways of handling it is appropriate. There is another approach, and that is confession. Confession works on this simple, basic premise, that there is a God from whom I come, to whom I go, through whom and for whom I live, and unto whom I am accountable. That is a simple, basic world view. You either have it or you don't. Let's suppose that you believe there is a God from whom you come, to whom you go, through whom and for whom you exist, unto whom you are ultimately accountable. It stands to reason that if there is that God and you are in a relationship with him, that all the circumstances of your life that induce the anger are relevant as far as he is concerned, and you cannot possibly handle them without relating them to him. Now, one of the obvious problems as far as handling anger is concerned for many people is simply this, that it never occurs to them that they need to be handling the anger-inducing circumstances in terms of the God from whom they come, to whom they go. They simply respond on this level, and there's no concept of the eternal, there's no concept of the divine. To handle anger properly, there has to be appropriate confession, which means I come before the Lord and talk about the circumstances, talk about the trauma, talk about my reactions, and begin to be honest with him about my feelings. Then And only then will I be in a position rightly to handle confession in the other dimension. And that is, I then begin to talk to the people concerned. Now, I don't know if you've noticed this, that sometimes when we're good and angry with somebody, we'll talk to them all right, red in the face, perspiring heavily, with our finger pointing at them, jabbing the air. That is the most inappropriate way of doing it. Fingers pointing at people, jabbing in the air, are reserved exclusively for preaching. They must never be utilized in anger. And always remember that when you point at somebody, there are three fingers pointing back at you. And that is a salutary reminder. Be careful what you're saying. When we handle anger by saying, you did this and you did that and you did this and you did the other, the natural response is to create a barrier. You find yourself in an adversarial position, and I'll promise you something, the situation will be improved 100 times worse if you go about it that way. There's another approach, and that is having confessed it to the Lord and got his perspective on the whole thing and found his grace in your situation to handle the situation, you then go to the person concerned, and instead of predicating everything on the you base it on the I. And instead of the pointed finger, the hand on the chest. I have a concern. I may be misunderstanding this. I need to tell you what I'm feeling about this. I got the impression that I think this. You begin to discover as you approach it on that level that there'll be a certain bridge built that you're more likely to find an empathetic response to your situation. Now, with all that in mind, let's look into Psalm 39 and see how the psalmist handled this anonymous traumatic event. Look, if you will, in the first three verses. And this is what he tells us. I said I will watch my ways and keep my tongue from sin. I will put a muzzle on my mouth as long as the wicked are in my presence. But when I was silent and still, not even saying anything good, my anguish increased. My heart grew hot within me, and as I meditated, the fire burned. Was he in repression? Was he refusing to admit that he was angry? No. Was he in expression? Was he letting it all hang out? No. He put a muzzle on his mouth. Was he in confession in the early part of it? No, he wasn't. What was he doing? He was in suppression. He was suppressing these angry feelings. And let's look very carefully at these three verses because there's much that will be helpful to us in them. Notice, first of all, what I would call a hasty reaction to these traumatic circumstances. His immediate reaction was that he made a very commendable decision. I will watch my ways and keep my tongue from sin. I will put a muzzle on my mouth as long as the wicked are in my presence. His commendable decision was this. I am in an anger-inducing situation. I fully realized that I could do some very bad things at this particular time under these circumstances. Not only that, I fully recognized that I could say some things out of my anger at this time which will exacerbate the problem. Therefore, I will make a decision. In the heat of the moment, I will watch my step and I will muzzle my mouth because I fully realize I can make things 100 times worse if I don't do that. A highly commendable decision. Notice his genuine concern upon which this decision is based. His genuine concern is, first of all, that he does not want to sin in what he says. But secondly, he also is very conscious of the fact that he is surrounded by ungodly people. So his two concerns are, concern number one, I fully realize that in a situation like this, I am perfectly capable of exacerbating the problem by sinning in what I say. Secondly, I have a responsibility to these ungodly people. And if in the midst of these ungodly people, I react to my traumatic circumstances in the way that the ungodly do, then in what way can I ever expect to have any credibility with them? Therefore, I have two concerns. In this anger-inducing situation, I'm concerned that I do not sin with my lips, and I'm concerned that I do not wreck my testimony among the ungodly. Very genuine concerns indeed. Now, how can a person sin with their mouths? How can they sin with their tongues, with their lips? All these expressions, of course, occur in Scripture. Well, James reminds us that the tongue is rather like the rudder on a ship. The rudder is very small, but it can steer a magnificent, massive ship through the ocean waves. In exactly the same way, he says the tongue is a very small member, but the tongue can steer us. It can make a profound impression, a profound impact on the lives that we live and the way that we conduct ourselves. We can sin, of course, with the tongue in cursing. We can sin in slander. We can sin in lying. We can sin in vengeful words. We can sin in ripping into people. There are all kinds of ways that we can sin with our mouth. And the thing that we must always bear in mind is this: the Scripture teaches us that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So that we have to be very conscious of this, that when we're in a traumatic set of circumstances, which are potentially anger-inducing, what comes out of us at that time through our mouths is indicative of the kind of person we really are. We might have the right evangelical gloss. We might carry the NIV at the appropriate angle under our arm. We may sing the choruses with enthusiasm, but it is highly possible and even highly probable that all this is masking an unwillingness to look at the way that we are actually behaving. And we'll find out when we hit our thumb with a hammer. Or we'll find out when somebody does something to us that we find demeaning. So we look at how we behave on the freeway. We look at how we behave in the parking lot. We look at how we behave in our families. We look at how we treat our kids. And we find that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And we need to be desperately concerned that in the anger-inducing situation, we do not sin with our mouths, or we do not wreck the testimony that we seek to have. Why would the ungodly think that godliness pays dividends if the godly, in traumatic circumstances, behave in a way that is no different from the ungodly? If they're just as objectionable and just as crabby and just as angry and just as mean and just as self-centered, if they drive the same way everybody else does and they push into line the same way everybody else does and react the same way everybody else does, why in the world would the ungodly people ever take godliness seriously? And the answer is they won't. This should be a major concern. And so we applaud the psalmist. He's made a commendable decision. He's out of a genuine concern. However, and here's the problem, I believe he takes this to a misguided extreme. Verse 2. When I was silent and still, not even saying anything good, my anguish increased. My heart grew hot within me, and as I meditated, the fire burned. No explosion here. There is absolutely no sense in which he is going to let it all hang out. No refusal here. He is fully admitting that he's hot inside. But he has made a decision, and it is this: I'm not going to say anything bad here, but I'm not going to say anything good either. Did you notice that? I'm not going to say anything bad here, but I'm not going to say anything good here. In other words, I'm not going to say anything, period. He clamps up. He clams down. He becomes removed. He becomes remote. Now, if he's not going to say anything good, how in the world is he going to have the fellowship that is so necessary for us to live discipled lives? You cannot be a disciple in isolation. If there is absolutely no way in which you're going to say anything good to anybody and not going to say anything bad to anybody, you're not going to say anything to anybody, and fellowship will be impossible. Not only that, if you're not going to say anything good, praise is ruled out and worship is ruled out. And if you rule out praise and worship and prayer and fellowship, how in the world do you think you're going to handle the situation? And so he becomes ingrown. He becomes inward looking. He becomes absorbed with his situation. He says nothing good and he says nothing bad. And as a result, we find something that is highly predictable. Notice what he says in verse 3. My heart grew hot within me, and as I meditated, the fire burned. Don't be misled by that word meditated. Usually when we read it in the Bible, we assume it means meditating on the things of God, devotional experience, private worship. That's not what he's talking about here. What he's talking about here is this. He's refused to say anything good. He's refused to say anything bad. He's become totally inward-looking and ingrown. And while he is doing that, he is meditating upon that which has led him to be angry. He's going over and over and over. He is regurgitating this thing. It's becoming a cancer within him. He is feeding on it, and it is feeding on him. And the fire is being stoked. And the longer he is into himself, the longer he is absorbed, the longer he is obsessed with these feelings, the more damage is being done to him. Jill tells a story of meeting a lady on one occasion. And this lady was telling her with great distress and great anguish of the abusive marriage that she was in. And she was talking with in great intimate detail of the abusive behavior of her husband, etc., etc. And it obviously was highly traumatic for her, but Jill said as she listened to the lady, she got the feeling that something didn't quite ring true. And so she said to the lady, "When did this abusive behavior last happen?" And the lady said, "Oh, we were divorced 15 years ago. So Jill said, "You mean the abuse that you're talking about stopped more than 15 years ago?" She said, "Yes. Oh, yes." And Jill said, "Well, it really didn't, did it?" She said, "It was going on this morning when you got up. It was going on last night when you went to bed. It was going on a few minutes ago while you talked to me. You're going over and over and over and over. You're reliving it and reliving it and reliving it. And you're feeding on it and it's feeding on you." There are dreadful things happening in our society. There are awful things happening in marriages. Incredible things happening in families. There are awful, awful things going on in our culture. And so many of them are related to the fact that people just aren't dealing with their anger properly. So the psalmist says in verse 3, "My heart grew hot within me, and as I meditated, the fire burned. Then I spoke with my tongue." And at this point, we hold our breath. What is he going to say? You say, "Oh, well, if he's been holding it in so long, he's going to be like the molten center of the earth. And one of these days, the volcano is going to burst. Look out, duck, guys. Here it comes. He's really going to blast everybody." Fortunately, he doesn't. Listen to these incredible words. "Then I spoke with my tongue." And this is what he said. "Show me, O Lord, my life's end and the number of my days. Let me know how fleeting is my life. You have made my days as a mere handbreadth. The span of our years is as nothing before you. Each man's life is but a breath." Notice that he takes a cooling off period. He takes a time out and he engages in some honest reflection. That's what's necessary, folks. Notice the direction of his reflection. He begins reflection through prayer. He begins to talk to the Lord. Now, you remember what I said a few moments ago, that if our worldview is predicated on the fact that there is a God from whom we come, to whom we go, etc., etc., does it not stand to reason that all the circumstances of our life, which are traumatic or non-traumatic, which either induce anger or do not induce anger, all the circumstances of our life can be and should be related to the one from whom we come, to whom we go, through whom and for whom we live? How in the world can we ever expect to handle the circumstances of life properly if they are not related to him? And yet that is exactly what we try to do. So the traumatic circumstances come and the anger is induced and we begin to deal with it totally on the horizontal level. We either repress it or suppress it, or we express it to the people. And really, do we recognize that what is needed is honest reflection in prayer? And we say, "Lord, we need to talk to you about it." You say, "Why would we do that? You're just spiritualizing what is clearly a psychological problem." I firmly believe that human beings are psychological creatures. I insist that human beings are primarily spiritual creatures. And I'm not suggesting spiritual answers to psychological problems, but I am saying there is no solution to this kind of thing if the spiritual dimension is divorced from the situation. There has to be a speaking with my tongue when I say, show me, O Lord. Lord, I need divine insight into this situation. Lord, I need your perspective on this thing. For without your insights and without your perspective, there is no way. There is no way that I can understand my humanity. There's no way I can understand my feelings. How in the world can I understand how people work? How can I understand what it means to be a member of society and a creature of culture if I divorce you from it? I need your insights. I need your perspective. What a profoundly significant thing this is. And how easy it is for us to forget it. It is common for us when we have problems to go to a counselor. That is most appropriate. But very, very often we look to the counselor to come up with all the solutions. It is not uncommon for us in our psychologically oriented society for us to look for psychological solutions to all our problems. That may or may not be appropriate. But the fact of the matter that we must insist on is we absolutely, imperatively must bring in the divine, eternal dimension to our consideration of the circumstances of our lives. So the psalmist says something very wise to the Lord. Show me, O Lord, my life's end and the number of my days. Show me my life's end. My life's end can mean two things. The termination point of my life when it comes to an end, or the purpose or the objective of my life. Sometimes we talk about the end justifying the means. When we talk about the end justifying the means, we're not talking about the termination justifying the means. We're talking about the objective, the purpose. Lord, I'm in a traumatic situation here. It's engendering and inducing a lot of anger in me. I've been stuffing it down inside. I wouldn't say anything good or anything bad. I've just become removed and remote and cold. But inside I'm burning and it's getting worse. I need to talk to you. I need your perspective on it. I need to understand your insight. And what I really need to know is, what is my life's purpose? Why am I here? Listen, if I don't know why I'm here, how in the world can I cope with being here? And a major part of coping with being here is coping with these circumstances. Lord, show me my life's purpose. Show me what the point of existence is. Why am I here? Well, if you're a good Presbyterian, you know the answer to this. You're being catechized, which sounds terribly painful, but it really isn't. If you've been catechized, you know the answer to the question, what is man's chief end? And the answer is, man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. Oh, Lord, show me my life's end. He says, I'll tell you what your life end is. I'll tell you what your purpose is. It is to glorify me. How in the world can I glorify God in traumatic circumstances that are inducing a lot of anger? That's a good question, and we need to be asking it. How can I glorify God in these traumatic circumstances that are creating a lot of anger within me? And the answer is, I glorify God by obeying him and by trusting him. That's the only way I can do it. So I look at this anger-inducing situation and I ask myself, in this situation, am I trusting God or am I looking for all kinds of ways of getting even? In this situation, am I trusting God or am I looking for ways of venting my anger and showing everybody that I'm right and everybody else is wrong? In this situation, am I obeying God? How am I relating to the people concerned? Am I relating in a manner that God tells me to, or am I relating to a manner in which the people at the Y tell me to? Am I relating to people in this situation on the basis of obedience to God and dependence upon his Spirit? Because if I'm not, there's no way that I can say that I'm glorifying God in this situation. And yet that is my chief end. You see, how in the world can we begin to think in these terms when we're ticked, when we're mad? We've got to be able to withdraw into his presence and recognize the place of honest reflection. But there's another sense in which he asks the Lord to give him insight, not only concerning his life's purpose, but also on the transient nature of his existence. Verse 6, he uses a dramatic expression. Man is a mere phantom as he goes to and fro. He bustles about, but only in vain. He heaps up wealth, not knowing who will get it. Here's the situation. As he reflects before the Lord now on his life's purpose, he then begins to think in terms of what a phantom he is. He begins to recognize how incredibly brief life is in the light of eternity. Think of that for a minute. How incredibly brief life is in the life of eternity. I had a good friend called Gunter Kiener. Gunter and I worked for many, many years over in Europe. On one occasion, Gunter was getting a bit frustrated with something, and I don't think I helped very much by saying, Gunter, it won't matter in 100 years. And he said, I know it won't matter in 100 years, but it matters now. Well, he was right and I was right. A situation does matter a lot when you're in it, but in the light of eternity, or if that's too difficult to cope with 100 years from now, does it really matter all that much? He says, oh Lord, give me a different perspective on this thing. Give me a different insight into this thing. Help me to understand what it means to be a human being, what the purpose of my life is, how brief life is. Jill's sister Shirley is one of my favorite people. She's been a real adventuresome sort. She used to race cars, and then when she was 60, for some unknown reason, she decided she wanted to learn to fly. So now she is flying around the country just for the fun of it. You'd think she's the biggest daredevil around the place. In actual fact, she's the most gentle, concerned, compassionate person you would ever meet. And she has a very simple philosophy of life. And this is what she says. Life is too short to fall out with anybody. Life is too short to fall out with anybody. Teach me to number my days. Show me how short my life is. Help us to understand the brevity of life in the light of eternity. Help us to understand the frailty of life compared to deity. My life is as nothing compared to you, says the psalmist. Lord, help me to get a handle on this thing. And help me to realize life's futility if I simply live on the material level. Man is a mere phantom as he goes to and fro. He bustles about, but only in vain. He heaps up his wealth, not knowing who will get it. Your kids will get it. They're already planning what they're going to do with it. You're rushing around figuring out how we can get this and how we can get that and how we can get the other. And they're all sitting down saying, when we get it, this is what we'll do with it. You heard about the kid who came to his grandfather and said, Grandfather, can you make a noise like a frog? He said, what? Can you make a noise like a frog? Well, he said, I don't think so. He said, could you try? He said, well, why do you want me to do that? He said, I just heard Mommy tell Daddy that when Papa croaks, we can go to Disney World. Something memorable in every sermon, folks. Okay, let's not forget the drift of what we're talking about here. Here's the anger-inducing situation. Here are the circumstances. He tries stuffing it. It doesn't work. The fire burns. And in the end, he realizes he needs to reflect on these things. He needs to come to the Lord in prayer. He needs to confess the situation to him. He needs to learn from him divine and eternal perspective. He needs to understand the purpose of existence. He needs to come to terms with his own humanity. If he doesn't, how in the world can he ever handle the situation? There's many a burning heart here. There's a lot of anger being reserved. We hold on to it as a very, very precious commodity, and we justify ourselves for it. After this reflection, there's a very healthy response, verses 7 through 11. But now, Lord, what do I look for? My hope is in you. Save me from all my transgressions. Do not make me the scorn of fools. I was silent. I would not open my mouth. For you are the one who's done this. Remove your scourge from me. I am overcome by the blow of your hand. You rebuke and discipline men for their sin. You consume their wealth like a moth. Each man is but a breath. He comes up with three very healthy responses here. Number one, A statement of confidence in the Lord. In these traumatic circumstances, in this anger-inducing situation, where does my confidence lie? Answer that honestly. Where does my confidence lie? From whence do my expectations come? Do I or do I not, in this traumatic set of circumstances, say, my hope is in you, Lord? I'm not going to put all my confidence in a church. I'm not going to put it in a support group. I'm not going to put it in a preacher. I'm not going to put it in a counselor. I'm not going to put it in psychology. All these things could be in your hands, O Lord, the means of bringing me relief and help. But my hope is ultimately in you. That's a profound statement. And that is where the believer has to be. A statement of confidence, but then a request for protection. Save me from all my transgressions. Don't make me the scorn of fools. Lord, my confidence is in you, but I'm very shaky. I'm very angry. I'm very upset. I'm all torn up inside. This thing isn't going to get healed overnight. You're not going to touch me with a magic wand, and I'll be just fine. And Lord, in the interim, while the healing is going on, and make it quick, Lord, please make it quick. But in the interim, while the healing is going on, please don't let me do anything stupid. When I'm going to make matters infinitely worse. And then he comes out with a remarkable statement. An acceptance of discipline. Listen to this. Verse 9. I was silent. I would not open my mouth. And while he was silent and while he didn't open his mouth, a dramatic thought occurred to him. For you are the one who's done this. Think of that for a minute. These traumatic circumstances, Lord, that have come into my life, it's just dawned on me. If you are the sovereign Lord, you were not out of control when these traumatic things happened. And therefore, in your immutable will, in your will that is beyond my understanding, in your eternal purposes that are beyond my comprehension, somewhere along the line, you allowed these things, for they were going to discipline me and they were going to mature me and they were going to help me grow. You say, I can't buy that. I don't buy that. Let me point out to you that if you don't accept the sovereignty of God in your circumstances, you've got major problems with God being God. Now, granted, if you do accept the sovereignty of God, you'll have problems with the love of God. But if you major on the love of God, then you'll have problems understanding the sovereignty of God. These two are not mutually contradictory. We have to hold them in tension. And this psalmist is coming to this remarkable conclusion. It is this: Lord, you have done this. You have allowed this. You have permitted this thing because it gives me the opportunity to grow. Now think of it for a minute. If an anger-inducing situation has come your way and you handled it properly, is it true that you deepened your relationship with God? Yes, it is. Is it true that you related to somebody in an extraordinary way? Yes, it is. Is it true that God was glorified in that extraordinary behavior? Yes, it is. Could it then be true to say that as a result of your responses and reactions in obedience and dependence to the Lord, you have grown in a way you couldn't possibly have grown without these trauma? And the answer is yes. That is exactly the case. Can I honestly say, Lord, my hope is in you. Oh, Lord, I'm very shaky. Don't allow me to transgress at this time. And Lord, I will bow humbly and reverently before you and accept that in your own sovereign purposes, you're allowing me in this situation the opportunity to grow and to mature. That being the case, we come to the concluding verses. Verse 12, hear my prayer, O Lord. Listen to my cry for help. Be not deaf to my weeping. For I dwell with you as an alien, a stranger, as all my fathers were. Look away from me that I may rejoice again before I depart and am no more. Lord, Please don't be deaf to my prayers. Lord, please let me sense your nearness. Right now, I feel somewhat alienated from you by my anger. And Lord, would you please hear my prayers and answer? And would you please draw me closer to yourself? And would you please do it before it's too late? Look away from me, and that I may rejoice again before I depart and am no more. You see, the tragedy is this, folks. If we're not careful, we can get such a habit of anger and resentment and bitterness that it becomes our pattern of life. It becomes our lifestyle. And we become more and more cramped and more crabby and more crimped and hard and bitter. Until in the end we go and nobody really cares. What a tragedy, because you see, we could be living our lives growing and maturing and developing and becoming renewed and refreshed, particularly as we handle our trauma properly. Let me ask you a question. Assuming you've gone through traumatic experiences, did you grow through them or did you sink into them? Did something positive and glorious result from them, or was it totally destructive and unhealthy? Where does the Lord fit into all this? Let's pray about it. Lord, I want to pray first of all for some people who haven't prayed for themselves for a long time. I want to pray for people who have never really acknowledged that they come from you and they go to you, and they exist to glorify you, and they've lived 20, 30, 40, 50 years, never got around to doing it, not even been interested in doing it. They have lived their lives bustling around. Their lives are slipping away on them. They're confronting their mortality. They're recognizing how frail they are. They may even be getting frustrated and angry that life has not delivered what they expected. And they want to come before you now, Lord, and they want to confess their independence. They want to confess where they've ignored you. And they want you to forgive them. They want to know your gracious touch in their lives. They want to understand their life's purpose. They want to recognize that before it's too late, they should be living worthwhile lives. Instead of being traumatized, instead of just reacting, instead of behaving the way so many other people are behaving who are ungodly. Lord, I want them to understand your love for them. I ask that they might understand the significance of Christ's death for them in order that they might be forgiven, this and all their other sins. I ask that they might understand that Christ lives by his Spirit to indwell them, in order that they might live lives that demonstrate something of your power and your grace. And in the quietness of their hearts, Lord, I pray that they might invite you to take over their lives, to forgive their past, to secure their eternal destiny, and to fill their present experience full of your grace. Now, Lord, I want to pray for those of us who've been believers for a long time but who still struggle with anger, still can't cope with it very well. The reason is that so often we simply operate on the earthly and the secular and the fleshly dimensions. We lose sight of our end. We lose sight of how transient life is. We lose sight of the fact that you do allow things in our lives that induce anger in us, not to make us mad, but to help us grow. Lord, help us not to be resistant of you. Help us to become submissive to you. Not because you're a great tyrant, but because you're a loving Father. Because you're a great coach. Because you know what's best for us. You teach us the way that we ought to go. And Lord, help us as we move on into the circumstances of this life to look and see if we do have a burning heart that we're stoking, either consciously or unconsciously. And help us to begin to bring to you the concerns of our hearts, see them in the light of your eternal purposes, to call upon your grace, and to see you deal with us in a way that will help us glorify you. Hear our prayers. Listen to our cries. For we present them in the name of the Lord Jesus. Amen.